City FM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM.
90. Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Prospects of war in Iran and Syria and nuclear Pakistan are ramping up at the same time. It's Eurogeddon. Sounds like an elite pincer movement with the public in the pincers. As we're being threatened with the mother of all multiple crises, we remind ourselves of US plans to invade the Middle East revealed to US General Wesley Clark 10 years ago, around about the time of 9/11. And also, we do what the mainstream press is afraid to do and ask, could all this be deliberate? Could Western elites, the bankers, corporations and the military-industrial complex be hoping to gain from their war and our financial demise? Also, London-based Sri Lankan Tamil freedom campaigner Ram Selvaratnam is here to help us discuss serious human rights abuses and the legacy of Britain's colonial past in his home country, what used to be called Ceylon. But first of all, we're going to have a little listen to Mervyn King, the Governor of the Bank of England. And Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is joining me. Martin, can you just give us an idea of his role? Because I get a bit fed up with Mervyn and his expressionless face. He seems to talk a little bit about some massive things that are going on in the world and enormous dreadful changes, but almost with a deadpan face.
That's what central bankers are supposed to do. They're supposed to play with a poker face. Because, of course, if they go out, we were talking about animal spirits earlier, Tony, if they go out there and say panic, then everybody's going to panic. So, of course, even then they're coming in with bad news, they've got to speak in a very calm tone of voice so that they don't upset anybody. And it's sometimes difficult for people to recognise what they're doing. Mervyn King, basically, is weighing every word, because then things he says can easily move the markets one way or the other, and that's why it comes across as a bit robotic.
He's talking about Eurogeddon this week, yeah. And he's talking about it as the situation being extremely serious. Now, he says this with a deadpan expression, a poker face. It's bizarre.
It is bizarre, but when people like him are saying Eurogeddon, you can bet...
No, he didn't actually say that was me, talk about the whole thing as being extremely serious.
Yes, it is extremely serious, and of course, in a sense, people like him who've been in charge are responsible for the mess.
But in another way, isn't it also silly? As well as being extremely serious. Well, because, you know, there seems to be some very simple solutions to a lot of this that these political leaders simply cannot agree on.
The problem is that the politics has all been corrupted by wealth and money. And it's not politically possible to talk about the obvious solutions because they're already been vetoed by the wealthy classes using their veto power. So basically, there are certain things we can't talk about. Like, we can't talk about raising taxes on the rich because we all know that that doesn't work, so that's out. We can't talk about investment for the future because we haven't got any money, so that's out.
Who's controlling the debate? Who's controlling that discourse?
By and large, it's controlled by those with money. Think about the people in charge. Think about Rupert Murdoch, the criminal man in charge of News International. He's a very, very wealthy man. He spends a lot of money making sure he gets his way. And there are lots of people like him, like the Koch brothers in the United States, who funded the Tea Party movement to the tune of billions. And then, of course, they're able to actually steer the political process in the way they want it to go. Ultimately, as a Polish friend pointed out to me, when you don't know what it's about the money. And ultimately, it's all about the money. And the people with the money control the process. Whether we're prepared to put up with that is another thing.
Well, so back to the man with the strangely expressionless face. That's King Mervyn, Governor of the Bank of England. He gave another pronouncement this week about the euro crisis, as reported by Channel 4 News' Faisal Islam.
From the Bank of England today, an unprecedented warning. Not this time about our banks, but about the impact of Eurogeddon on our banks and our economy.
No one who looks at the current position could surely deny that it is extraordinarily serious and threatening, and therefore those with responsibilities to deal with it really do need to take action. If there's a choice between distributing money or keeping it to bolster resilience, our recommendation to banks is to ensure that they retain it to bolster their capital resilience.
Well, extraordinarily serious and threatening as well, he says there. But he then goes on to say, those who have responsibility to deal with it must deal with it. Well, doesn't he have responsibility?
He does. I mean, basically, the bottom line is, in a private sector run economy, and of course the banks are actually propped up by the state, but they're still pretending that they're private sector. In a private sector economy, all that the central bank governor can say, can you bankers please be a bit more responsible, please? Now, in actual fact, in a publicly run economy, we would just say, do it. The Chinese, for example, have still got state-owned banks. Chinese Communist Party says, right, no bonuses. They mean no bonuses. But in Britain, they just say, oh, please don't pay some bonuses. It'll look really bad and it'll upset everybody. And that's all they can do.
So what happens to old Mervyn if nobody actually takes any notice of him?
Well, they're not going to take any notice of him because they're looting everything that's in sight. He's like one of those ineffectual supply teachers trying to prevent 4C running riot. And he's pleading with them, please, please don't smash the school
up. Don't the Bank of England actually have a role in all this? Surely they do.
They do, because what's happened with the Bank of England, it's a nationalised bank, but it was made independent by Gordon Brown, which means, of course, that in actual fact, the bankers and the private bankers basically have their ear. So they are supposedly policing these people, but in actual fact, they haven't got the will to do it.
So you'd paint a picture of these international financial gurus everywhere, these bankers everywhere, infiltrating even the Bank of England.
Absolutely. Of course, the Bank of England. That's the first. What do you do if you're a gangster? You try and control the police force. You try and get your people in there to make sure that
that's right. They say, we don't rob the banks anymore. We own them.
Exactly. And of course, the Bank of England, basically are supposedly there to protect the interests of the public, has basically been suborned by these private interests. And we're going to have to restructure the whole thing, including the Bank of England.
So I'm going to pit our in-house economist, Martin Summers, here up against former Wall Street trader Max Keiser and one of his guests this week, Carl Denninger. Carl runs a website called MarketTicker.org, one of the financial commentators who sees Wall Street and the city as fundamentally corrupt and broken. And here he is talking about the IMF running out of cash. This is one of the big problems affecting the euro crisis, is that the IMF is actually stony broke, according to Carl Denninger. So let's have a listen to that.
The IMF is either drawing up plans or not drawing up plans for another $800 billion rescue of Italy and Spain. If all its member nations are bankrupt, then where does the IMF get the money to rescue these bankrupt member nations, Carl Denninger?
They don't. So, I mean, I think it's a curious thing that they floated this rumor. It was somewhere $600 billion or $800 billion. I don't know where they think they're going to get the money from because it doesn't exist. They increased their special drawing rights allocations, of course. But the problem is that the IMF has to be funded by subscriptions from its member nations. And thus far, I think something like two or four of those nations have actually passed the allocations. The rest have not, including the big ones like the United States. So I don't know where they think they're going to get the money from. And I actually found the headline rather amusing. It was good for a big pop in the futures, but I don't see where the there is there.
Right. So you mentioned special drawing rights, and this appears to be going to be a kind of a new global currency in which to roll up all of this bad debt and reprice it, resecuritize it, create new maturities, and basically increase somehow the debt bubble to even new heights of absurdity.
So, Martin, is that a bit of commentary there from Max Keiser and Carl Denninger something you'd agree with?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, basically, they've run out of resources because they won't raise taxes on the rich, because that's ruled out and we can't discuss that. Therefore, there is no money. Therefore, they're inventing money, whether it's quantitative easing or special drawing rights, in order to plug the gap. But people don't believe it's real money, and they're right, it's not real money. And I think the stage we're in now, that we've had 4 years, and the government should have taken the banking system by the scruff of the neck, beaten 10 tons of crap out of it, and then restructured it. They didn't do that, and now there is no option but a crash.
But surely the other option is that they could simply default on the debt. Is that the same?
That's what will
crash?
Happen. Countries will default, banks will default, individuals will default, and that default will work through the system. Ultimately, debt doesn't have to be paid, and in actual fact, logically, debts that can't be paid won't be paid, which is what Keynes pointed out in the 1930s.
But I mean, in a way, isn't this all just money on screens? This is little blips.
Absolutely.
On screens, and
absolutely,
surely it can be sorted out.
Only by getting rid of all the debt, which means that the wealthy classes who hold a piece of paper saying we are owed this debt will have to lose their money, and they are desperate not to lose their money, so everything has got to go down the drain to pay them back. But it won't work, and ultimately there will be a crash, and the wealthy classes will walk away with whatever they've been able to loot, and then we're all going to war. It'll be great fun, won't it, hey?
Well, one of the other things that they were discussing Carl Denninger and Max Keiser was the Occupy movement, and Carl raised some fascinating points about it all, about the Occupy movement and exactly what it's campaigning about.
Finally, let's talk about the ending, this never-ending bailout for banking and market-rigging fraudsters. The CME Group, in their latest 10Q, listed Occupy Wall Street as a threat to their bottom line. So who's the bigger threat here, Carl Denninger, Occupy Wall Street or the bankers who their own fraudulent activities?
I don't know, to tell you the truth, Max. I think the problem with Occupy Wall Street today is that they are still trying to figure out exactly what they stand for. And I have pointed out, I'm on a couple of their mailing lists, and I've pointed out to them that if they get into the "we want free blankety blank," I'll save you from the bleep, that they're going to end up being relegated to the dustbin of history, because there is no such thing as a freebie. It has to come from somebody. On the other hand, if they stay focused like a laser beam on the fraud in the financial system, they have the potential to do what the Tea Party failed to do, and that is to get the public focused in its righteous anger on what's been done to them. I don't know which way this is going to go. On the other hand, you have the European banking system that is teetering on the edge of collapse. You have all of these institutions, including ones in America, that bought up all this debt in sovereign Europe, thinking that this was going to be some great investment because it was trading at a fabulous discount. The fact of the matter is that it was trading at a fabulous discount because they can't possibly pay. So how you're going to resolve those two things, I'm not sure. But frankly, I see both of them ending very badly sometime next year.
All right, Carl Denninger, we're out of time. Thanks for being on the Keiser Report.
Thank you.
All right, and that's going to do it for this edition of the Keiser Report with me, Max Keiser, and Stacey Herbert. I want to thank my guest, Carl Denninger of MarketTicker.org. You can follow Carl on Twitter at TickerGuy. You can follow.
That's the end of the Max Keiser Report from this week. That is broadcast on the Russian English language channel on Freeview Russia Today. Martin, he's saying something there which is, I think, is particularly important, which is that the Occupy Wall Street movement, and obviously the Occupy movement around the world, thousands of these camps are not, he believes, actually focusing on what they should be, which is the financial fraud, the individual frauds that have been taking place in the system. Do you think he's right about that?
Well, he may be right about that, but it's asking a lot of a movement which has been created out of nothing by brave people over several months. Of course they're learning on the job. Many of these people, we had a young girl speaking at the Occupy Bristol Speakers Corner event earlier, and she said, "I'm studying business studies and I want to know more about what's going on. I feel I need to know more, but I don't know enough." And I think that's one of the problems we've got, is that there's massive economic illiteracy and lack of education. But people going into the streets and starting to talk to each other is the first step to knowledge. And of course, we must, you know, the Occupy movement has got all sorts of strands of people in it with all sorts of life experiences, and people are asking too much if they're supposed to come up with a solution in 4 months from the street when the people at the top haven't managed to come up with a solution in 4 years.
And what about the bigger picture in other parts of the world? Because this financial crisis, although it's centred in Europe and the United States, is affecting other countries too, as is the sort of military rollout in the Middle East. How do you think the two are connected? Because you quite often say, "Oh, well, we're going to have a war, we're going to have a crash, we're going to have a war." What connects the two? Why do you think?
Well, what connects the two is the elite, which is pushing both things, basically. And, of course, what tends to happen...
But how does it help an elite to have their own people in their own countries, in their home countries, you know, in Europe, in the US, suffering during a time of war? Surely that they
well,
would want...
The fact is that what they're doing is running the economy to suit themselves, and when people start to get wise to it and start rising up, they then, as it says in Henry V in Shakespeare, to giddy their giddy simple minds with foreign quarrels. So stop worrying about the fact that you've lost your pension, your job, you've got no hope, no future. We've got no Iranian threat breathing down our neck. We've got to get serious about national security. And this is the same old trick that was played in Germany in the 1930s. And if you think this ruling elite is not capable of playing those tricks, I've news for you. They are quite capable of playing those tricks.
Well, we're going to have some music now, and after that we're going to be looking at an old British colony. It's called Sri Lanka. It used to be called Ceylon, with our special guest Ram Selvar Ratnam.
Every move we make, we're all included on their list. disagree. Cause when the madman flicks a switch, then the clear will go for me. Starvation, but I just cannot see the point. Cause there's so much food here today that no one wants to take away.
That was the Fun Boy 3 from, about 20 years ago, which the Lunatics have taken over the asylum. See if you can spot the connection with our previous item. Anyway, London-based Sri Lankan Tamil freedom campaigner Ram Salvaratnam is here to help us discuss some of the serious human rights abuses and the legacy of Britain's colonial past in his home country, that used to be called Ceylon. Hi, Ram, and welcome to Drive Time.
Yeah, hi.
Can you first of all tell us really about the different ethnic groups in Ceylon or Sri Lanka?
Ceylon became Sri Lanka as a republic in 1972. That was done to just change a constitution that the British left behind in 1948 when Ceylon was granted independence, but it wasn't a republic. It had minority protection rights. The Tamils always saw themselves as a nation, but there are Tamils who are about 18-20%, and Sinhalese, there's a small about 5% of Muslims, and the Tamil population is now very much less. Many people have just fled or been chased away, and it's a little bit more complicated than that. That's what I would say. It's in a nutshell. So in 1972, it became Sri Lanka, which was basically a whole change of the constitution and protection rights for minorities that was there. It was enshrined in the British constitution that came up in 1948. So here we have this problem now. In 2009, thousands of people have been massacred under a complete media blackout, where papers and TV stations, they all self-censored themselves around the planet.
I mean, I can remember seeing at the time, this is a couple of years ago, a couple of the news programs were actually showing satellite photographs of massive groups of people that you could really only describe as herded around by, with people around the edges, quite clearly with guns, but these were pictures taken from the satellite. So what on earth was going on there?
If I remember right, if you're talking about the same images, I think they are from drones. Lots of drones there. There are drone armies. It's God knows where the drones come from, but then again, anybody who knows what's going on in the world and arms trade, no, they're footage from drones, and it's managed. News was just coming out in a managed way, and there were, if I remember right, it was being the Defense Department of Sri Lanka was saying this is the Liberation Tigers of Tamililam who were spearheading the Tamil campaign for a separate state. At what point they had a separate country, almost a de facto state, with lots of people living there, about 300,000 people, that was disputed by the government of Sri Lanka, aided by everybody, including the UN agencies, never really came up with the figures that eventually came out of there, even after so many deaths. About 300,000 people were incarcerated in totally illegal camps. And this was these people. The government had claimed there were only 70,000 people at one point. And it was these poor people, you know, who were deliberately targeted for a few months, you know, and that was the end, how they came out. And it was that.
But I mean, at the time they were arguing that, hang on, these guys are the Tamil Tigers, and therefore we need to fight them rather than just agree with them and welcome them into the political process. There's a fight going to go on because they're an armed resistance movement.
What can I say, really? I must admit, I haven't been paying attention to the conflict. I had given up. I ran away. But you couldn't look away the other way, you know, especially when protests started coming out here, out on the streets and blocking the roads in central London, and it was blocking my way. I got to see more and more what's going on and followed up the past 4 or 5 years prior to 2009. But I gave up when peace talks were out in the open after about 2002. They came together, sitting in many global venues, and there were... The last I remembered was there were peace talks underway between the LTTE and the Sri Lankan government, and monitored and aided by four nations, and now lots of information is coming out who else was behind it, and it seems like everybody was behind some peaceful negotiated settlement. And
so the, what was going on in London was a massive rally, wasn't it, which blocked Parliament Square roughly at the same time as all this was going on over in Sri Lanka.
What has happened is, like, around 2006, a new government came into being, a new president who was a previous prime minister, and he's called Mahinda Rajapaksa, who's a current president, and I would call it a regime, as that's the word people are beginning to use now globally. Sri Lankan regime, the current regime, started to say we'll come to a military solution to this problem, and that's had started around end of 2006 or maybe 2007, but it culminated in 2009, and that's when the media blackout. That's what made people. Sri Lanka has always been misreported. The issue there has been misreported, and people had got used to BBC and all these places not reporting it properly.
So, what do you want to put the record straight now and explain? You know, how it should be reported. Explain in your own words.
How it's being sort of reported now, in some sense, that the UN has come up with facts that they come up with a number like 40,000 people were killed. And when the government of Sri Lanka, for the last 2 years, 2.5 years, they've been maintaining there was a zero civilian policy. What they implied was there were no civilians were killed. So here we have UN coming up with a figure through a report that's disputed, whether it's a UN Secretary General's report or is it a report commissioned by him. It's a huge number, 40,000 people. And in the modern day, we have this sort of... total misreporting that 40,000 or tens of thousands of people were brutally killed, and what the UN has said or other sort of investigations that have come up, like for example the Channel 4 recently released a documentary called The Killing Fields of Sri Lanka. It's still probably available on Channel 4 OD, and it says, it sort of puts the argument that people were deliberately targeted, civilians were concentrated, or other people are probably saying this, which I believe it's true, because I experienced it myself in 1991. People in a much smaller scale, people were deliberately concentrated into a place and targeted through bombardment from
Now, Martin, this is an old British colony. We have a certain amount of responsibility in this country for what happens there. How do you think this fits into what's going on in the other rest of that region? Because, you know, it's very, very close to India and Pakistan. There's lots going on in that part of the world right now.
Yes, I mean, if you think back to the history of it, the movement of Tamils from South India into Sri Lanka was by the British colonial authorities because they wanted a workforce to work on the tea plantations which they created. And it's very similar to lots of, if you think of Palestine or Ireland, Britain has gone around the world creating or setting up potential conflicts and then walking away and saying, hey, there's nothing to do with
us. So why bring the Tamils in? Why not just have Senegalese?
They found the local people a bit too unbiddable, you know. So they thought the Tamils would be good workers.
Or was it possible? Or was it possible that they brought these people in deliberately to create a kind of divide and rule situation?
This is divide et imperatum, isn't it, or whatever it is in Latin? Divide and rule. The British have played that game all over the planet, and of course, it's led to a horrible legacy, which we're still dealing with in lots of parts of the world.
Now, Ram, can you see a way through this? Can you see the possibility for reconciliation between the communities in Sri Lanka in the future?
Possibly. There will be. I want it to be, but I want to correct something there with all respect to Martin. This is what we need, some clear understanding. There's been a lot of lies and history has been rewritten a lot of times. What is Tamil homeland is, you could argue, the southern part of India, the Tamil Nadu state, and the northern eastern parts of Sri Lanka or Ceylon, or a name for the island had been Ulam, and Tamil Ulam means that where the Tamil people live. That's where these Tamil people are, sort of, who have got the courage to leave the place and then find the freedom to speak, are demanding. That's what it's turned out. The people who were fighting for it there, they've been put down. And you cannot mention the name Ulam or Tamil Ulam. The people who live in this area are original people of those lands. The Tamils who were brought in as indentured labor were also from Tamil Nadu state, which is a huge state. It's about 60-70 million people, or 60 million, let's call it 60 million people. They were taken to Guyana, Fiji, and to central hills of Sri Lanka or Ceylon then, to work on the tea plantations. I think there's a bit of confusion here.
Okay, I stand corrected. Yeah. I mean,
thank you. Thank you.
I'm not trying to argue with you.
No, I'm just saying what I've heard.
Okay, so Ram,
can I say where the reconciliation is through knowledge? This is a deliberate campaign that has been launched. I have seen activists who are on the wrong side of things here putting this information out that Tamils have been brought in by the British. You know, okay. In fact, what the British sort of conquered the whole island around 1815. The colonial era starts with the Portuguese crash landing there in 1505, and then 100 years later, the Dutch taking it over from the Portuguese, and then the English taking it over from the Dutch in 1815, when they conquered the whole island, including the central hills, which was largely inaccessible. About 1830s, early 1830s, three distinct kingdoms there were brought together, because it was a small island divided up. There were three distinct kingdoms, and there was definitely a Tamil Sinhalese division amongst those kingdoms, which had probably warred for generations. Mm-hmm. But they must have lived in peace also, you know. And British put them together as one administrative island, mm-hmm. Ceylon, which was the former Portuguese name Ceylon, was just turned into Ceylon and became famous for his tea and other plantations. And so that type of culture over land, the way people have abused the land and borders, and again we now see like rubber plantations being planned for the conquered lands of the Tamils. That's where things are going. The whole old British model, it's not to blame it on the British people, but there is a model that was all done through the East India Company. I see it as a reconciliation has to come through, if there is, it's by determining and accepting the rights of the Tamil people that's been denied, not only by military force, but through knowledge and just information out there. That has to be made very clear, you know.
Can I just add something to this, which gives a local flavour? Mr. Liam Fox and Mr. Werity made quite a lot of visits to Sri Lanka because they're very close with the Sri Lankan government. These are the ministers that have just been pushed out of the British cabinet for, it was the defence minister and his friend, and they were pushed out because they were seen to be doing things which were not supposed to be happening, having meetings all over the world with people they shouldn't have been meeting. And one of the places they were going back to, backwards and forwards a lot, was Colombo. And they are Mr. Fox, who's an MP for Portishead, isn't he?
North Somerset.
Yeah, North Somerset. He's a big friend of the current Sri Lankan government.
Well, what you seem to be implying, Martin, is that the present regime, as you said, regime Ram, over in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. is actually just a kind of Western, ethnically they're not Western, but they're just working for the West now.
Not entirely, I wouldn't say.
There you go. When you say the West, this is where we need clear information. And one of these biggest sources of information where it made a biggest impact is the recently leaked the full database of the U.S. cables on
WikiLeaks.
Through WikiLeaks. Now, that paints a totally different picture. It shows some sort of a neoconservative agenda that's been pushed around, and Sri Lanka was at that time, the way things turned out, was one of those few people who just with both hands just grabbed it. The current regime built up out was built on it, about 2002 early or late 2001, the neoconservative regime, if you may pose, the Bush administration asked Sri Lanka to stand out of the international criminal courts, the charter of the International Criminal Courts, which they were going to sign, and they didn't sign it, and there we go. Now we have somebody who has killed lots of people, massacred lots of people, thinking they share some secrets with some very powerful people, and things are deconstructing all around the world, and things are coming out.
I think Mr. Werity and Mr. Fox were over there to sell weaponry. That's one of the interests they have.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the political orientation of the regime in Colombo, they buy lots of weaponry. And who sells weaponry? Well, we do.
Well, Martin, I wonder if you can bring us on to talk a bit more about the Middle East now and the Russians, because we've had in the last couple of weeks quite a big move from the Russians, which is a deep unhappiness, really, with NATO's new missile defence shield, or they call it a defence shield, whether it really does that isn't quite clear, and the Western takeover in Libya, also preparations to attack Syria by fomenting a similar armed insurrection to that in Libya. Medvedev is clearly moving on this. Where do you think this is all heading?
Well, I mean, people may like to realise that there is a Russian carrier battle group in Tarsus in Syria. So the Americans turned up with their aircraft carriers the other day to sort of threaten a no-fly zone over Syria, to find that the Russians had beaten them to it, and they got their aircraft carrier and four nuclear submarines ready to go. And basically, they're standing in the way.
Well, they're also very much instrumental in making sure that NATO can actually get supplies through to troops in Afghanistan.
Oh, yes, there's also talk of them cutting. I mean, so the Pakistanis have just cut off supplies through Pakistan to NATO in Afghanistan, and the Russians are also considering cutting off. You could have a situation where the British Army and the US Army is trapped inside Afghanistan, no way out, and no supplies.
Well, just after 9/11, the former US commander, General Wesley Clark, was privy to a secret Pentagon plan to invade the Middle East, which makes one think perhaps that the West has been fishing for excuses to attack in the Middle East. So let's have a listen again, a timely reminder of this talk by Wesley Clark, the former US general.
10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but
we got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Well, this is worrying, isn't it, Martin? If that plan really does exist, Wesley Clark's a pretty senior figure. He was the main US representative over in the Balkan conflict.
He was, and he also stood to be a Democratic presidential candidate as well, so he's probably slightly on the liberal side of US politics. But this plan clearly does exist. The Russians know, the Chinese know, and of course they've been preparing. They know the plan exists, and of course when they try and put it into practice, they're going to find that the Russians and the Chinese have thought about what they're going to do if they put it into practice.
So what about the strategic implications of the Iranians actually moving towards being a nuclear power? Because the Israelis, of course, have had several hundred nuclear weapons for decades now.
It's nothing to do with the Iranians having nuclear power or nuclear weapons, as has just been made clear. They've got a plan to attack these countries for other reasons, and this is just the excuse.
So why is it then that that we don't get the different reasons or the arguing about whether, you know, even in Parliament it seems a lot of these invasions, the Libya thing, goes through on the nod, for example?
Well, that's because they don't want the ordinary people to know what they're up to, so each individual case is presented as, oh my goodness, what are we going to do about Syria, Libya, Lebanon, you know, fill in the gaps. And it's all being treated as, oh, we don't really know what's happening, we're just being dragged along by events. But we know they've had a plan all the way. They had a plan in 1964, Operation Northwoods, and people can look it up on their search engines, a plan to plant bombs and carry out massacres inside the United States in order to blame it on the Cubans and invade Cuba. That was a really existing plan, and it was signed off by the whole US general staff, led by General Lyman Lemnitzer. Don't kid yourself about the US military and their bosses. They are basically warmongers. They always were, they still are.
Well, 3 weeks ago we heard from the University of Alberta, Canada, Professor Anthony J. Hall, whose mammoth tome, Earth into Property, we're recommending for the thinking person's Christmas. So, by popular request and to get our discussion juices going, here he is, going deeper into his view of the modern empires, using money and the IMF as a colonial weapon rather than guns and soldiers.
I'm Anthony J. Hall. I've just finished a 16-year project, 2 volumes. Collectively, those 2 volumes are The Bowl with One Spoon. Volume 1 is The American Empire and the Fourth World. Volume 2 is Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism. I'm happy to announce that Earth into Property was chosen by The Independent as one of the best books of 2010. I look at the process of globalization since 1492. I look at empire building, and I look at the resistance of indigenous peoples and how indigenous peoples, by combining together, creating larger coalitions, have been engaged in a form of anti-imperial globalization. And I try to situate the movement that doesn't accept that global capitalism controlled by a few powerful corporations, that this is the destiny at the end of history. I've tried to draw on that history of indigenous peoples in opposing and resisting earlier forms of imperial globalization, and saying we can draw on that history to understand better where we are in history and how we can join together and form coalitions and develop ideas of ourselves in bigger and bigger ways, transnational ways that we can develop along with, let's call it the Tahrir Square Global Freedom Movement. I mean, obviously, when you look at Mubarak and the crimes and oppressions of that regime in Egypt, who put Mubarak there? Mubarak was, you know, in a sense, a middle manager in a much larger global system, a global empire. So we need to oppose that. We need to find ways to resist that, to redirect history towards a sustainable, ecological, viable way of life develop economics that actually conform with ecology, conform with how nature, which is ultimately the real economy, and where all our good things, where all our health, where all our nourishment ultimately comes from, the natural world, you know, we're destroying it. This capitalist system that we live in now, our life maintenance systems actually are killing the natural system, the true economy that we need to sustain ourselves. So how do we oppose this? How do we transcend the poisonous mental environment? For instance, War of 1812, I just gave a paper on Dick Cheney, his new book, his new memoir. He gives his reflections on 9/11, and he looks back at the War of 1812, and he says, the British burned down the White House back in the War of 1812, and now Al-Qaeda has shown it can hit us in our midst. Well, actually, during the War of 1812, indigenous peoples following Tecumseh created a larger confederacy of peoples and worked with the British Empire in the hopes of creating like a fixed polity within the British Empire. It would probably have been called Indiana, north of the Ohio River. So there's an example of indigenous peoples resisting, making alliances. So we're going to have to make alliances. We're going to have to build bigger and bigger coalitions of power. For instance, trade unionism, we have to draw on that history of organizing workers. Workers can have a tremendous influence by withholding their labor. That's a very important thing. You know, the Battle of Seattle, it was sometimes referred to as turtles to teamsters. You know, the environmentalists, the ecologists trying to make the world a place where turtles can survive, where frogs can survive, where buffalo can rejuvenate themselves, where, you know, we can have biodiversity. That's a whole important political movement, ideological, intellectual, even spiritual movement. Women still continue to be oppressed in our own societies and in many societies, and we need to address that. So we need to think how these ecological issues fit with women's issues, gender issues, and ultimately, you know, the anti-war movement has been so important historically. To my way of thinking, until you deal with the lies and crimes of 9/11, it's very hard to deal with the invasions that come out of these lies and crimes. That in order to be effective as the peace movement, as the anti-war movement, you have to deal with the roots of this current succession of wars that we're told again and again are to oppose terrorism. I mean, the very concept of a war on terror, what a monstrosity, what an idiocy. I mean, war is terror. How do you have war against terror? The religious communities of the world, I mean, after all, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, were all Abrahamic religions. Go back to a common source, it's all monotheistic religions.
That's Anthony J. Hall there speaking about his book, Earth into Property. Now, Martin Summers, the whole point of what he's saying there really is that actually capitalism is becoming almost like a kind of parasitic monster on the surface of the earth, and that people who are using money to actually destroy the earth itself and actually to destroy some of the natural systems that we depend on to survive. So whereabouts is this heading? Because it's quite a worrying concept, and he seems as if he's pretty accurate in what he's saying there.
Well, basically, capitalism has run its course. People have got to accept that. Certainly, free market capitalism, financialized capitalism is finished. The question is, what comes next?
But there's nothing wrong with money itself, is there?
Because we've got to reform the money system.
This is elevating money up to a higher degree than it really should be in society, and making it kind of almost like a god.
Well, exactly. And money, of course, is not the same thing as investment in things like making stuff and curing people of illnesses and all of the practical things that people need to do every day. The financial economy has basically eaten the real economy, and we've just got to basically, the game is up, the game is over for us and for them. It's the end game. It's us against them. We've got they've got the guns, but we got the numbers. Here we go.
Sri Lankan Tamil Freedom Campaigner Ram Selvaratnam is still here. Ram, can you just give us your idea of on what we were just been talking about here, which is this kind of global, almost like a sort of capitalist octopus, which seems to be not only connected with these global arms companies and putting people in place in places or other parts of the world who are actually not really serving the interests of their own people, but are serving the interests of a financial elite. I mean, how have you experienced that in your dealings in Sri Lanka and since you've been campaigning back over here? Where do you think it's all going?
Yeah, what I have gathered, that's what I would say, over the, looking very carefully at it, because it's serious things that happened there. Tens of thousands of civilians were being killed, and everybody seemed complicit to some sort. They thought they would hide it. They thought the government of Sri Lanka will not go all the way and some resolution can be found. But at that time, everybody stood exposed, and the geopolitics of that area came out. And it's not about Sri Lanka. It's about the whole Indian influence in that area, which is in the middle of the East Asia, West Asia, and it's South Asia also, you know, and the sea routes.
So do you think the Indian government has got its beady eye on Sri Lanka, thinking, actually, we would like to control this island. We don't like the idea of having an island off the Indian coast that we don't control.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's natural. India being a big landmass there, they've been very much involved in getting the whole conflict just to this level.
What about their spending on arms? Because I know at the moment that they're spending quite a lot of money, aren't they, the Indians?
According to the Foreign Policy magazine, for the second year running, India is the biggest arms importer in the planet. It's like something that can be shocking to many. This is how the knock-on effects of all these global conflicts are getting to.
Martin, do you think that's a consequence then of the ramping up of tension in Pakistan and in the Middle East around India?
Well, exactly. I mean, the arms race between Pakistan and India is an insult to all the poor people in both countries. It's a disgrace. And, of course, this India is the swing state in a lot of things. So, for example, both the Chinese and the Russians are making overtures to the Indians, and so are the West, because they are, you know, which way India swings will determine World War III, basically. So that's why they are such an important place. And of course, Sri Lanka is very important in Indian politics. You remember the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi and so on. It punches above its weight in Indian politics, if you like, just like Ireland does here. Only a small country, but it causes an awful lot of trouble.
Now, Martin, we've also had the news this week that the Pakistani government has got rather annoyed, particularly last weekend, with NATO and NATO's killing of its soldiers, and has now actually cut off NATO's supply lines. As we were saying earlier on, the Russians are actually allowing NATO, would be unthinkable 20 years ago, the Russians are allowing NATO to supply their troops in Afghanistan via Russia now, and the Pakistanis have just simply cut off the borders.
Yes, they have, and they're very angry. I mean, 25 of their regular soldiers who are based in recognised bases were given a two-hour assault by Apache gunships and Groundhog attack aircraft. And they were actually radioing up saying, stop attacking us, please, you know who we are. And, of course, the suspicion in Pakistan is that the West wants a war with them. And, of course, there are plenty of people in Pakistan who are prepared to pick up that gauntlet.
It's a very
dangerous situation, because you've got all of these conflicts, and there's right and wrong on every side in all of these conflicts. It's not simple, is it? Everybody's got different views. But we need negotiations and common sense and to take tensions down. But, of course, the way the West is at the moment, they're spoiling for a fight everywhere. And, of course, they're provoking similar belligerence in their opposition, whether it's the Russians, the Chinese, or whoever. And we've just got to stop this mad drive towards war. It's not in the interests of ordinary people anywhere.
Well, let's have a listen to what William Hague has to contribute to that particular point, Martin.
The safety of our staff and of other British nationals in Iran is our highest priority. We have now closed the British embassy in Tehran. We have decided to evacuate all our staff. And as of the last few minutes, the last of our UK-based staff have now left Iran. We will work with friendly countries to ensure that residual British interests are protected and that urgent consular assistance is available to British nationals. We advise against all but essential travel to Iran. At present, there are no indications that British nationals outside the embassy are being targeted in any way. Those requiring urgent consular assistance will receive help from other EU missions in Tehran.
Now, that was William Hague speaking on Wednesday this week, announcing the closure of the Iranian embassy in London after an attack by students on the British embassy in Tehran. Martin, where is this taking us?
To war. Where else? I mean, these are the kind of things that happen on the way to war. That's where we're going. And of course, it was the reason the Iranians are annoyed is because we've just crashed their central bank because they supposedly tried to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in the US, which nobody believes apart from William Hague and a few others.
Well, you say we crashed their central bank, but that's through sanctions.
Sanctions, indeed. But I mean, that's an act of war. Yeah, if I try and steal your money, you're likely to say no, you're not having it. And the Iranians therefore responded by saying, right, we'll get your embassy out of here.
And this was all based on a supposed attack on the Saudi ambassador.
Yes, and
on
their supposed pursuit of nuclear weapons, which nobody's been able to prove they're doing. The report that they're ramping up basically is exactly the same facts and figures they came out with in 2003. There's no evidence for them developing nuclear weapons, and that's what the IAEA has been saying. But it's being presented to the British people as if we've got no choice here. We've really got to go to war with Iran, even if most of the people in the country can't find it on a map. This is what's the problem with Britain, is that we want to go to war with everybody, places we can't find on a map. We ought to learn to mind our own business, like countries like Norway. We'd be a lot better off.
But all this is going on where we've got a financial crisis in the West at the same time. This is what I find incredible, is that we've got a ramping up of a Middle Eastern potential nuclear war situation with Israelis involved. The Pakistan is a nuclear power. And then we've also got a Eurogeddon where we're facing in, I think, is it 9 days' time now, apparently?
Well, I mean, the fact that these things come simultaneously should surprise nobody. In the 1930s, the financial collapse led, after a few years, because nobody got anything sorted about it, to the rise of Hitler, which led after a few more years to the beginning of World War II. But of course, World War II started when the Italians invaded Ethiopia in 1936. It was going on in the Spanish Civil War. That phase of World War III has already started, the small brushfire wars, the wars in Ethiopia and the wars in Spain, for example, in the 30s. We've already got the war in Sri Lanka, the war in Pakistan, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, which hasn't finished, of course. Car bombs go off every day. The war everywhere. And of course, that's just the prelude to the big one. And in actual fact, the people in charge are criminally insane. And it's a real insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars that these people are in charge. They haven't got a clue, and they're actually going to lead us to disaster.
And as the obvious solutions to the financial crisis, that is debt forgiveness and nationalising banks, are ignored month after month, we hear from Aaron Russo, a friend of the Rockefeller oil and banking dynasty. And he tells us what Nick Rockefeller told him the financial elite have a nasty surprise prepared for us to replace money.
I met Rockefeller through a female attorney I knew who called me up one day and said, one of the Rockefellers would like to meet you. I had made a video called Mad as Hell. And he'd seen the video and wanted to meet me and knew I was running for governor of Nevada. So sure, I'd love to meet him. And I met him and I liked him. And he was a very, very smart man. And we used to talk and share ideas and thoughts. And he's the one who told me 11 months before 9/11 ever happened that there was going to be an event. And out of that event, we were going to invade Afghanistan to run pipelines from the Caspian Sea. We were going to invade Iraq, you know, to take over the oil fields, establish a base in the Middle East, and make it all part of the New World Order. And there's going to be this war on terror, which is no real enemy. And the whole thing is a giant hoax, you know, but it's a way for the government to take over the American people. 9/11 was done by people in our own government and our own banking system to perpetuate the fear of the American people into subordinating themselves to anything the government wants them to do. That's what it's about. And to create this war, this endless war on terror. And that's why and that was the first lie. And the next lie was going into Iraq, you know, to get Saddam Hussein out with his weapons of mass destruction. The fact of the matter happens to be that the whole war on terror is a fraud, it's a farce. Because you can't define a winner. There's no one who's going to beat, so it goes on and on forever. And they can do whatever they want. They scare the hell out of the American public. Look, this whole war on terror is a fraud. It's a farce. It's very difficult to say it out loud because people are intimidated against saying it. Because if you say it, they want to make you into a nutcase. It was 9/11 that allowed this war on terror to begin. And until we get to the bottom root of 9/11, the truth of 9/11, we'll never know about the war on terror. The ultimate goal that these people have in mind is the goal to create a one-world government run by the banking industry, run by the bankers. And they're doing it in sections. The European currency, the euro, and the European constitution is one part of it. Now they're trying to do it in America with the North American Union. where everybody has an RFID chip implanted in them. All money is to be in those chips, right? There'll be no more cash. And this is giving me straight from Rockefeller himself. This is what they want to accomplish. And all money will be in your chips. So instead of having cash, anytime you have money in your chip, they can take out whatever they want to take out whenever they want to. If they say you owe us this much money in taxes, they just deduct it out of your chip digitally. Total control. And if you're like me or you, and you're protesting what they're doing, they can just turn off your chip, and you have nothing. You can't buy food. You can't do anything. It's total control of the people. Everything is in there. So they want a one-world government controlled by them, everybody being chipped, all your money in those chips, and they control the chips, and they control people. And you become a slave. You become a serf to these people. That's their goal. That's their intentions.
Now, that's a pretty horrific vision there, Martin. That was Aaron Russo there, who's now passed away, but that was about 4 or 5 years ago, speaking to Alex Jones. Aaron is a Hollywood film producer, and he's a fairly sensible chap, but he was very friendly with this guy Nick Rockefeller after he stood for to be governor of one of the big US states, Arizona, I think it was.
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting speculation that that's what's going on. I suspect it could be just cruder than that. You don't need to put chips in people's arms to control them. You can do the normal way with electricity, batons and bullets, and they will certainly be using them.
And before we finish, I'd just like to let Ram tell us about some websites and campaigns that he recommends.
Yeah, okay. Two websites I'd like to say that people can keep contact with is something that I like. One is a humanitarian aspect of it. They've been mounting protests at NALSI and places like that, quite local to here, is act-now.info, act-now.info.
Okay.
Another one with a broader left outlook is tamilsolidarity.org.
Okay, thanks very much. That's all the serious talk out of the way. Coming up next, Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 7, followed by the Fresh Bud Party. It's Tony Gosling here. We're on thisweek.org.uk.
BCFM News from the Sky News.